Sorry, that was a little loud. I'm not going to introduce myself. I think I've done that enough. But I want to welcome you to our fourth and final showcase panel, but yet not the end of the day. This is our panel on race in the law after SFFA. I will thank in advance all of our panelists, but I want to thank in advance and particularly welcome our moderator, Judge Lisa Branch. Judge Lisa Branch serves on the 11th Circuit and has since 2018. More importantly, she is often involved in Federalist Society events, both here and abroad. She's a good friend of the organization, a good friend of mine, and perhaps critically, a good friend of my wife's. So, with that, Judge Branch.
So thank you, of course, to the Federalist Society. Next year will be my 25th year of involvement with this wonderful organization. I have enjoyed every moment of it, and in large part due to my friendship with Dean. I've enjoyed talking with him, planning with him, coordinating with him, but most of all, my friendship with him and Luann. They have made this venture together with the Federalist Society even more enjoyable, and I truly can't thank him enough for all that he has added, all the value he has added to this organization, and it's always an honor to have him introduce me before I begin a panel. So thank you, Dean. So in this final showcase panel, we are gonna cover race in the law after SFFA. A little over a year ago, the Supreme Court issued Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard and a companion case against UNC, holding the admissions programs of the private college and the public university, both of which took the applicant's race into account, violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Writing for the court, Chief Justice Roberts explained, "Both programs lack sufficiently focused and measurable objectives warranting the use of race in a negative manner, involve racial stereotyping, and lack meaningful endpoints. We have never permitted admissions programs to work in that way, and we will not do so today." The court's pronouncement is succinct and definite, but the court continued, acknowledging that there is still a role for race in the admissions process. And the court said at the same time, as all parties agree, nothing in this opinion should be construed as prohibiting universities from considering an applicant's discussion of how race affected his or her life, be it through discrimination, inspiration, or otherwise. But the court ended with a final warning. Universities may not simply establish through application essays or other means the regime we hold unlawful today. What cannot be done directly cannot be done indirectly. After the opinion was issued, Harvard, UNC, and college and universities across the country issued statements in response to the opinion. Harvard's reaction was shared by many. Harvard said, "In the weeks and months ahead, we will determine how to preserve, consistent with the court's new precedent, our essential values." What does preserving our essential values in the admissions process look like going forward? How will colleges and universities comply with this decision, and will litigation follow their efforts? What will the racial composition of campuses look like in a post-SFFA world? Our distinguished panel will address these issues during its discussion. I'm going to briefly introduce our panelists in the order in which they will speak. Please note, of course, you will find more detailed biographies on the website. Each panelist, just to give you an idea of the format, which should not surprise anybody, they will deliver brief remarks. I will then engage the panel in discussion before we turn to the audience for questions. Let me start with Professor Kyle Rosema. He is a professor of law and co-director of the JD PhD program and academic placement at Northwestern Law School. He also taught at Washington University School of Law and Chicago Law. He has a JD from Washington University Law, as well as a PhD in economics from Cornell, and a BSE in mechanical engineering. Earlier this year, he published a working paper which examines how racial diversity in U.S. law schools changes after affirmative action bans. In particular, he looked at 12 state-level affirmative action bans, and he's going to discuss the results of his paper today. Professor Sonia Starr is a professor of law and criminology at the University of Chicago Law School. She previously taught at Michigan Law, the University of Maryland, and Harvard Law. After she graduated from Yale, she clerked for then-Judge Merrick Garland of the D.C. Circuit, and her research focuses on the criminal justice system and on discrimination and disparity. She will discuss what SFFA left open and how we should evaluate whether what universities are doing now is permissible post-SFFA. And now the man who is causing me to, from now on, call everybody by their first names, Professor Peter Arcidiacono. He is a professor of economics at Duke University. He received his PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1999, and he's best known for his work in college major choice, affirmative action, and higher education. He served as an expert witness for the plaintiff in SFFA v. Harvard and the companion case against UNC, and he examined the role race played in the admissions process at both institutions. He's going to discuss the importance of the SFFA cases for discovering how racial preferences operate and the size of racial preferences in the past, as well as the different reactions by schools to the case. And finally, last but not least, Professor David Bernstein. He holds a chair at the Scalia Law School. He teaches constitutional law, evidence, and products liability, and he is the executive director of the Liberty and Law Center. He is a prolific author and has written two highly rated books, which might be of interest to this audience, Rehabilitating Lochner and Classified, The Untold Story of Racial Classification in America. And he is also a blogger, and I follow him on Twitter. He will argue that in the aftermath of SFFA, we should reconsider the racial classification system imposed by the government in the late 1970s with the goal of having it fade into insignificance to one's life prospects. And now let me turn it over to Kyle.
Well, thanks. Most of my research uses data to study different aspects of the legal profession. And the project I'm going to tell you about today is with Rick Brooks and Sras Sangha, where we document trends in racial diversity in U.S. law schools, and we estimate the impact of state-level affirmative action bans on racial diversity. Let me start by telling you where the data comes from. So the ABA has a publication each year going back to 1980. So here's a snapshot of one of the pages. And so for each law school in each year, it lists how many total students there are in the first year, second year, and third year. And so this first number here is the number of all students in the first year. So the next number is the number of women students, and the final one is the number of minority students. And so what we did is we collected this data from 1980 to 2019 or 2020. On roughly 200 law schools. And so I'm gonna show you some stats about the diversity of the country overall and of college grads. These just come from census tables. Okay, just to get an idea for the geographic distribution of diversity. And so in white, so we basically say what states have roughly the average, diverse student body. Blue is more diversity, and red is less diversity than the average state. You can see here is right states like California, Texas, mostly in the South, have law student bodies that are more diverse on average over the entire period we study. And so the first thing we do in the paper is we document trends in racial diversity. And so what I'm going to show you here is just the minority share across all law schools over time. And so on the x-axis is just the year. And so you can see here the minority share of law students increased from around 10% in the 1980s to almost 30% by the end of our sample. So if you compare this to the population share increased from around 20% minority share to about 40%. And so if you compare the two and look at the increase over time, right, there was a 20 percentage point increase in the minority share of law students. There's roughly a 20% minority share of the population. And so what this means is that changes in the minority share of law students since 1980 roughly tracked changes in minority share of the population, but it didn't catch up at all, right? It's always been roughly the same percentage point difference between the two. We also compare law students to recent college graduates, right? You have to go to college to go to law school. And so among recent college graduates, we see roughly similar trends to the population overall. Okay, so our data identifies for each law school the minority share. And so the overall trends I just showed you really mask differences between law schools. And so we're able to use the data on law school level minority shares to document differences in minority shares across law schools over time. And so what I'm going to show you here is the percent of law schools that have different minority shares. And so what this shows you here is what percent of law schools have at least 30% minority share at the law school in that given year, right? And so you can interpret this, in the 1980s, less than 5% of law schools had at least 30% minority share. By the end of our sample, 40% of law schools had at least 30% minority share. Right now, so if you add up both areas here, this tells you what share of law schools had at least 20% minority share, right? And you can see here, less than 10% of law schools did in the 80s, and now more than 70% of law schools do by the end of our sample, right? You can continue breaking this down. What about the other side, right? And so if you look over here, in the early 1980s, 65% of law schools had less than 10% minority share. By the mid-1990s, this became less than 20% of law schools. What about the very extreme? And so in the 1980s, roughly 30% of law schools had less than 5% minority share. By the mid-1990s, there were basically no law schools with less than 5% minority share. Okay, I'm going to show you point out one last thing here. And so if you look at differences across racial diversity, even today, across different law schools, you see massive differences, right? So there's 10% of law schools that have less than 15% minority share, right? Now think about double that. So there's 40% of law schools that have more than 30% minority share, right? So even today, there's big differences in racial diversity across law schools. Okay, this was just the raw data, just plotting it for you. The main part of the paper studies state-level affirmative action bans on racial diversity. And so starting with California in the 1990s, they passed a state-level affirmative action ban for public law schools in the state. I'll tell you a little bit more about which law schools in a second. A couple other states also had affirmative action bans in the 90s moving forward. So in the 2000s, we get a few more states banned affirmative action in public universities, including law schools, a handful of other states in the 2010s as well. So we're going to study each of these changes. So we're able to use 12 different state affirmative action bans. We're able to study almost 20 law schools in those states. And so here's just a breakdown. Just to give you an idea, we have, you know, some law schools. So the tier here are just based on U.S. News law school rankings, right? So you have some tier one, which we refer to as top 14 law schools, like Berkeley. There's some tier two schools, like UCLA and University of Texas. Here's the changes since 2000, right? Another tier one, Michigan is in here. A lot of the states we study just have one law school that we're going to be studying. And so what we do is we estimate what's called a differences in differences framework. I just want to show you work through the intuition on how we're actually going to estimate the impact of these state-level bans on diversity. And so what we use is called a stacked event study design, and I'll explain where that term comes from in a minute. Okay, so we have different events, right? And so this is just whether a given law school can no longer use affirmative action at admissions. And so what we do is we go event by event, and we construct the treated group and a set of control groups. So take the Berkeley event in 1998. What we're gonna do is look 3 years before the event, 5 years after the event, and go look for a control group. And so what we do is we use other law schools within the same tier. And so Berkeley and Michigan, they're tier one, so we're only gonna use other tier one law schools as the control group. So for this one Berkeley event, we're gonna say, okay, the control group are gonna be other law schools other than the ones that are treated at some point, right? So we're not gonna use Michigan as a control group because University of Michigan also was subject to a ban at some point. And so now we have one event with a set of controls for this one event. So now we do the same thing for the next event, right? Michigan. So we look 3 years before the event, 3 years after the event, go identify control law schools, right? So now what's key is we have a bunch of events, right? Each law school can no longer use affirmative action, and we're gonna redefine the time dimension. So on the x-axis here is year, but we're gonna say for each event, define event time, which is zero for the year that the law school can no longer use affirmative action. So now the x-axis becomes event time, and this is where the name stacked event study comes from. We can just stack all the events on top of each other. And so the way to think about what we're able to estimate is for each event, there's one treated law school and a set of control law schools. We're just gonna compare the treated law schools to the control law schools across all the different events. So here's the main results. So the x-axis here, this is the event time. So the y-axis is the difference between the treated and control law schools. And so in the lead up to affirmative action ban, the difference is pretty stable. But then in the treated law schools after the ban, you see this big decrease in racial diversity in the law schools. And so on the other y-axis here, right, levels off around 17%. And so what this means is that when states ban the use of affirmative action in public law schools, racial diversity in those law schools decreased by 17% relative to what we think would have happened if the state didn't ban the use of affirmative action. So just to conclude, so we found the change in racial diversity in law schools. It kept pace with the changing demographics of the U.S., but it didn't catch up. The differences remain roughly the same. There remain big differences in experiences between law schools. And we found state-level affirmative action bans decrease diversity by 17%. So I didn't tell you about this. Starting in 1999, we actually have breakdowns by different racial groups, and so we're able to ask, well, what explains that 17% decrease? We find that the entire decrease is explained by decreases in Black and Hispanic shares, and we find no impact on the diversity in terms of Asian American shares. We also find that there's a bigger decrease in racial diversities in elite law schools, right? So in top 14 law schools, we find affirmative action ban decreases diversity by 25% compared to a 16% decrease in other law schools. And so, I look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Hi, I'm gonna sit here if that's okay. Can you guys hear me? Thank you, Judge Branch, and thank you all for being here and to FedSoc for inviting me. I want to focus on two main points, one legal and the other about the interpretation of ambiguous. I want to focus on two main points, one legal and one about the interpretation of ambiguous empirical facts. So the key legal point is that after SFFA, it remains constitutionally permissible to try to promote racial diversity so long as colleges don't treat individual students differently based on their race. They still have available to them race-neutral alternatives to affirmative action. The key factual point is that when we're trying to figure out what schools are in fact doing, whether they're complying with SFFA or instead surreptitiously circumventing it in some way, We should not get too hung up on the demographic numbers that they are currently reporting, especially in this first season, because those numbers are amenable to so many plausible causal explanations that they really don't tell us very much at all, at least taken alone. So let's start with a legal issue. I'll say here that I'm not here to argue with the merits of the SFFA decision or to suggest that it's okay for universities to try to circumvent it. The decision's the law. I think that universities in general know it. But we need to be specific about what that means. What did SFFA prohibit and what did it not prohibit? So what SFFA prohibited is affirmative action, i.e. racial preferences and admission. Universities must not give weight to an applicant's race itself in admissions. All applicants must be considered under the same race-neutral criteria. But affirmative action has never been the only tool that universities have to promote racial diversity on their campuses. They've always had many other options. One example is the Texas 10% plan, a geography-based admissions policy that was explicitly designed to preserve diversity after an earlier ban on affirmative action in Texas. There's many other examples, many of which are very much on the table now, right? So many people have suggested, for example, that now that universities are stopping race-based preferences, they should also take a hard look at legacy admissions, which are essentially a form of affirmative action that at almost all schools primarily helps white students. And others have said, let's rethink athletic preferences, especially for certain sports that are dominated by prep schools. Many people have said, let's try to make schools more socioeconomically diverse, which we can do through tools like increasing financial aid, maybe giving preference to first generation students. And when we do that, not only will it address socioeconomic diversity itself, which is valuable in its own right, but racial diversity will, to some extent at least, come along with that, right? And some people have said, look, we do need to think about race and why it is that that certain groups are underrepresented on campuses, but our focus shouldn't be on university admissions because that's essentially too late. What we need to look at is the pipeline, right, and address racial disparities in educational opportunities for kids in America. And maybe universities can help with that, say, by offering summer enrichment programs for kids, high school students, and so forth to try to get people better prepared for college and improve the pipeline, right? So I'm not here to judge the policy merits of any of those. That's not my expertise. I'll note that none of what I just said, I think, is a particularly radical idea. I think to care about underrepresentation of Black and Hispanic students on campuses is not an idea that requires you to be kind of committed to every aspect of kind of modern DEI ideas, right? Like lots of people across the political spectrum want to find ways to address these issues. My point here is that there's nothing constitutionally amiss with any of the things that I just suggested, and that remains true even if one of the reasons for suggesting them is that you care about the racial composition of campuses. So none of the things that I just suggested are affirmative action in disguise, right? The crucial difference is that under everything I just suggested, each applicant would still be judged by criteria that are the same, right, that don't take race into account. That's a big difference. It is not just a technical difference, right? And when that's the case, the key concerns that the court raised about affirmative action, like stereotyping or lumping large groups of dissimilar groups of people into racial categories or stigmatizing students from disadvantaged groups who will be assumed to not have met the standards that everyone else met, none of those concerns apply to those race-neutral tools. And so the SFFA decision didn't prohibit diversity tools like that, only affirmative action. And in fact, as Judge Branch mentioned, the court didn't even require total race blindness on the part of admissions officers. It said they could consider an applicant's race-related experience, but only insofar as it illustrates in a very individualized way qualities that make them a good candidate for admission, such as, say, the resilience that might be demonstrated from having overcome an experience of discrimination. What admissions officers can't do is to use that as just a way of kind of collecting race information and then using it to give weight to what the court calls race qua race, right? Race in itself. Crucially, in all of this, the court didn't deem racial diversity an unconstitutional or unlawful interest. Far from it. The court actually gave quite a bit of space and I think respectful discussion to UNC's and Harvard's stated educational interests in diversity, and it in fact described those interests as commendable and worthy. The problem was the means, right? The problem was the tool that was used to try to advance those objectives. Now, to be sure, the court did hold that UNC's and Harvard's diversity interests were not compelling in the sense that they could justify a race-based classification. But there is a large gulf between compelling on the one hand and unconstitutional on the other hand. In that gulf lies almost everything that government does, right? Like normally, we don't second guess every policy interest that policymakers in all kinds of institutions pursue, but we also don't say that most of them justify the use of racial classification. And there in that gulf now lies educational campus racial diversity. As an aside, I think it would have been quite shocking if the court had suggested that racial diversity was not even a permitted objective anymore, given that it had treated it as a compelling one for 50 years. It also would have been quite shocking for courts to suggest that universities couldn't pursue race-neutral alternative strategies anymore, since its doctrine had affirmatively favored those approaches and treated them as kind of presumptively, they were the thing that universities had to consider and rule out before they could even consider moving on to affirmative action. It would have been surreal, and indeed the court didn't do it. And if you want other evidence of that fact, the fact that basically the court's admonition against indirect affirmative action, while I think it has content, it is not a bar on all consideration of diversity, right? So you can look at some of the separate opinions. So Justice Thomas, for example, favorably cites the efforts of the University of California and Michigan after the elimination of affirmative action to enroll racially diverse classes by race-neutral means. Justice Thomas says these race-neutral policies may achieve the same benefits of racial harmony and equality without any of the burdens and strife generated by affirmative action. Meanwhile, Justice Gorsuch also describes alternative admissions practices as not being race-based. He says Harvard and UNC could obtain significant racial diversity without resorting to race-based admissions practices. Many other universities across the country have sought to do so just by reducing legacy preferences, increasing financial aid, and the like. Justice Kavanaugh states, governments and universities still can, of course, act to undo the effects of past discrimination in many permissible ways that do not involve classification by race. And this is consistent with, for example, comments by Justice Thomas and Justice Alito in the Fisher cases, in which they spoke positively of the Texas 10% plan as a non-discriminatory way in which students were admitted. So why am I hammering this point so hard? Because there's a legal movement out there to try to push the implications of SFFA beyond what the court actually decided, and to argue that even totally race-blind admissions policies must fall if part of the reason that they were adopted was concern for racial diversity. Those efforts actually began even before SFFA was decided. The kind of leading edge cases was a bunch of challenges brought to public magnet schools, which were sued even though they had race-blind admissions policies. Essentially, essentially for caring about the underrepresentation of Black and Hispanic students and for using that to choose among different race-neutral admissions policies. So those lawsuits seek ultimately to establish the principle that governments, as well as universities governed by Title VI, assuming this gets extended, the theory gets extended at the higher education level, that those entities must be completely colorblind in their purposes and not just in the actual policies they implement. The legal theory relies on a false syllogism, but a tempting one, I think. The plaintiffs point out that it's well established in case law that comes from more traditional civil rights cases that a facially neutral policy is constitutionally suspect if it has a discriminatory purpose, or put another way, if it has a disparate impact that is intentional rather than incidental. And they say, well, if we think that the purpose of increasing Black and Hispanic representation is such a discriminatory purpose, because everyone understands that at least in a zero-sum context like university admissions, it means necessarily reducing white and or Asian representation. I think the problem with that logic is that it's just not true legally or normatively that every race-related purpose is the same, such that all of them taint race-neutral tools in the same way. So for decades, our case law has distinguished between invidious and benign racial motives, between the purposes of including and excluding, desegregating versus integrating, chipping away at the many racial disparities in our society versus seeking to expand them. Policymakers at every level of government and far beyond education have taken for granted that it's okay to engage in thinking like this. And this is not a partisan issue, right? So if you look at Google President Trump's Platinum Plan, you'll find a website with a list of policy-based objectives for Black communities, like building wealth in Black communities, encouraging business investment, reducing racial health disparities, and the like. Certainly, the Democrats have similar sets of proposals like that. There's lots of disagreement about how to do all of this, what to prioritize, et cetera. But the mere idea that we should care about the ways in which our society still bears the legacy of decades of lawful racial discrimination, the mere idea that we should care about that is not constitutionally suspect. And if it were deemed so, it would potentially taint countless policies across countless areas of law and really open a Pandora's box of litigation. Fortunately, our law has not done that, and nothing in FFA changes it. I think that's enough on that point. Let me speak to this the empirical point that I mentioned. So schools are prohibited from engaging in affirmative action, whether it's an explicit matter of policy or something more surreptitious that they're doing. And so they do have to change their admissions policies in the wake of SFFA. So how do we know whether they have done so? What facts would tell us, would suggest that, like, hey, this school isn't just doing the things it's still allowed to do, but is in fact breaking the law? So I don't have an easy answer to that question because there isn't one obvious smoking gun to look for, right? Throughout the history of U.S. civil rights law and litigation, it has been hard to detect unlawful discrimination and differentiate it from lawful decision-making, and that has been a challenge for civil rights plaintiffs in lots of areas, right? That's sort of inevitable because we generally don't require every decision maker governed by civil rights law to walk the public through every aspect of their private decision making, and this situation will probably be similar. I'll tell you what I think isn't a smoking gun, which I'm afraid that too many people are currently focused on, and that's the reported demographics coming out of schools in coming classes this year. So as many of you know, not long after winning in the Supreme Court, SFFA sent letters to a large number of universities basically saying, you better comply, we're gonna be watching you, we're gonna be looking at the numbers you report, and we're gonna be prepared to sue you. And then this fall, when everybody started reporting numbers, a few elite schools, in particular Yale, Princeton, and Duke, came back with numbers that didn't show what SFFA apparently thought every school's numbers should show. Black and Hispanic admissions didn't fall, and Asian American admissions didn't rise and even fell a few points. So based on this alone, SFFA promptly sent those schools letters, indeed threatening to sue them. And I want to say, hold up, this is not even close to grounds for a lawsuit or for suggesting that you have some kind of a right to detailed information about the private decision-making of private entities. You can ask, but you don't have a right to it. It's not really grounds even for particular suspicion. Yes, it is logical to expect that the elimination of affirmative action will cause diversity to drop at many and perhaps most elite schools. That is an overall effect of the market that we should expect. It's what people predicted in the SFFA litigation itself. But we should not expect that to happen uniformly at every school or even at every elite school. To me, it's quite unsurprising that when you are watching dozens of elite schools like a hawk, you're going to see a few that don't match the general pattern. And that would be true even if all of the schools, including those schools, are complying with SFFA. One reason relates to the legal point I've already made. Schools have many available, entirely lawful tools for preserving diversity. They're free to consciously pursue that aim. I strongly suspect that many schools are trying to do so, and some of them may be being more effective than others, which is going to give them a larger share of the available pool of Black and Hispanic applicants. That in and of itself is not a legal problem. Second, even setting this aside, even assuming all every school did was just jettison affirmative action and change nothing else about their process, you still wouldn't expect every school to show the same demographic effects. And here's why. Schools don't admit students in a vacuum. They compete with one another fiercely. And even at the top levels, they compete for yield. They compete for who applies in the first place. And so the composition, for example, of Duke's entering class is not just determined by Duke's admissions decisions. It's determined by the admissions decisions of dozens of other elite schools with whom Duke competes, and by the choices made by tens of thousands of students about where to apply and what offers to accept. And the Supreme Court's decision in an SFFA was notably different from the state bans that affected individual state schools, because it didn't just affect one state. It didn't just affect Duke. It affected all their competitors at once, right? So the students in the elite college applicant pool who are affected in one way or the other, whether they're helped or harmed by the elimination of affirmative action, the vast majority of them, they're not going to end up not going to college, right? They're going to land at different colleges. And that means that some students will gain in different classes of students, and others will lose. And so even the ones that were getting into the very top school, maybe they won't get to their very top choice, but they're still going to end up somewhere very elite. So Duke doesn't get some of the students it would have admitted. It does get some students that it wouldn't have gotten otherwise, right? Should we affect the net effect to be ex ante? We don't know, because we don't know the relative pre-SFFA effect of affirmative action on all of those schools. We don't know how they compare with each other in terms of which of these like alternatives to affirmative action they're pursuing. I think we should expect heterogeneity. I think maybe affirmative action's defenders invited a little bit the skepticism that they're facing right now. I want to acknowledge that, because they said, you know, it's going to be like you threw a bomb into our numbers. And I think maybe they overemphasized the experience, honestly, of Michigan and the University of California, because those schools lost affirmative action at a time that none of their private competitors or out-of-state competitors did. It really was a hard hit to their numbers, because they were essentially competing with their competitors for Black and Hispanic students on an unlevel playing field. But that is not just what just happened with SFFA, and so we should expect more complicated, less predictable results. Final, very short point is that the numbers themselves could potentially be misleading. One thing is that different schools don't necessarily report race the same way. Some of them categorize multiracial students differently, international students differently, et cetera, and they don't necessarily characterize them the same way over time. And many of them have a pretty strong incentive to look like they're not losing diversity after SFFA, because they may, you know, be a little worried about letters coming from from SFFA, right? But they may also be very worried about their constituencies who really care about their diversity numbers. Also, the numbers that are reported depend on students being willing to identify their themselves by race. And here I'll add one bit of empirical data from a survey I conducted last spring commissioned Qualtrics to carry out a national survey of people who applied to college in last year's cycle and in the cycle before SFFA. And one of the questions I asked was, did you identify your race via a checkbox when you applied? And the only big change that I saw after SFFA was a 13 percentage point drop in Asian students saying that they had identified their race. You might ask why. I think, you know, we didn't ask why, so we don't know the answer to that question. But only retrospectively have I thought we might have asked why. So if I'm speculating, I'd have to say it's probably that if it was an effect of SFFA, it probably wasn't an effect of the actual court decision, but rather the zillion media stories out there surrounding the decision about how terrible it is to be an Asian student when you're applying for college. Like, maybe that caused fewer of them to check the boxes, and that might mean that the drop that you see at some schools is artificial. It's just a reporting problem. Okay, I've probably talked for way too long. So, thank you.
Peter.
All right, that was the presentation. So my background on this is I've been doing research on affirmative action for some time, and as a result, had the opportunity to serve as an expert witness for Students for Fair Admissions in their lawsuits. And I think a lot of why I was very interested in this is all the debates about affirmative action are really ill-informed, because we actually, if you say you're for affirmative action, it's not clear what that means. It's sort of like saying I'm for the minimum wage. Well, does that mean you're for a $10 minimum wage or a $50 minimum wage? And we don't really have the data, generally, to even say what it means. So if we look at, think about what happened in the Supreme Court cases prior to SFFA, we had sort of those twin Michigan cases, where in one they said you can't use an explicit point system for your race, and the other said, well, you can do it holistically. Now, if you're going to rule for one of those and not the other, I would have preferred it to be flipped myself, because I want everything to be sort of above board here. And what was going on, you can see actually what some of the liberal justices said. You see the suitor saying equal protection cannot be an exercise in which the winners are the ones who hide the ball. I think this still applies now. And Ginsburg, if honesty is the best policy, surely Michigan's accurately described, fully disclosed college affirmative action program is preferable to achieving similar numbers through winks, nods, and disguises. So up until SFFA, we get some hints as to how racial preferences operate. And to the extent that we know something, it's actually from people who have been pretty courageous in terms of trying to get the data. So to me, I think somebody like Rick Sander on the law school front did a tremendous service by filing the Freedom of Information Act requests and trying to make the data public as to what the heck was going on. And Students for Fair Admissions did a tremendous service on that. And you could say, well, yeah, if you're pro-affirmative action, maybe you don't feel that way. But without that lawsuit, you don't know how big the legacy preferences were either. It really took, you got to look behind the veil on this for the first time. So what I'm going to do is go through a little bit about the numbers, both in the public record and then that came about through the court cases, to show you, you know, how these preferences operate, how big they are, and hopefully provide a little bit of nuance to all this. So first of all, why do we have affirmative action? Well, because we do have really big problems prior to college. These are the distribution by race for getting above a 1390 on the SAT score. Okay? 25% of Asian Americans get above a 1390 on the SAT. That's 8% for white students and 1% for black students. There are different ways of looking at these numbers. There's an anti-racist way, which would say the test must be biased. There's a racist way, which would say we're stuck with this. But this is somewhat fixable. Roland Fryer has shown ways of addressing these sort of test score gaps. And until we do something about that, it's all a mirage about any affirmative action actually fixing the underlying issues. So what that leads to, when we do have affirmative action, what does this graph show? We're going to create something called an academic index. It's just a combination of your test scores and grades. And what I'm showing you is what that distribution looks like for minority students admitted to Berkeley. And I'm comparing that to white applicants to the UC system as a whole. And what you'll notice is that the distributions are pretty much the same. So you have white students who may be rejected from Riverside. They're in that group in terms of applying as a whole. And their distribution looks a lot like what it looks like for minority students. This is before affirmative action was banned by Prop 209. Okay? So there are big, big preferences operating. Just from what we can find public record. This data comes about. They could have been admitted, could have not. It's a whole set. Yeah. If you look at it for law school, this is at University of Michigan around the time that they're deciding this case. And this is, again, a combination of your LSAT scores and grades. And the dashed lines are for white students. I have one that's for accepts and one that's for rejects. And what I want to point out is that the distribution for white rejects to Michigan looks, if anything, slightly better than the distribution of black admits. Okay, now that's happening in equilibrium because some of the people who would have really high LSAT scores and grades, they weren't applying to Michigan because they knew they could get into Harvard with those things there. And if you look at where the 50th percentile, sort of the average, the median black admit, where they would fall on the white admit distribution, it's the second percentile. Okay, so we're talking about pretty substantial preferences. If we look at what happens at Harvard, and I should say, I'd studied affirmative action before. I didn't know much about how the performance of Asian Americans before I took the case. And it was shocking to me. If this is the share in the top 10% of the academic index decile, again, a weighted combination of test scores and grades. And now this is where I need my glasses, Asian American, it's a huge share, 57% versus 1% for African American. And if you made things based on solely test scores and grades, all groups go down except for Asian Americans. Now, they don't do it based solely on grades, okay? You wouldn't necessarily know how big the preferences are if you just looked at admit rates by race. They wouldn't look all that different. Well, why is that? Well, Harvard actually does a great job of getting black students who have no chance of admission to apply to their school. We've got a paper on this with the data that was revealed in the case. And so if you look at the share in the bottom decile, so bottom 10% according to academics, 43% of that is African American. Of that group, unless you were an athlete or a legacy or something like that, you had two admits across the 6 years. Okay, so these people are not getting in. Okay, so this is a conversion to PowerPoint, but that doesn't tell you, that's just the raw data. We can actually estimate models of admission and say, okay, well, what does that tell us about how big racial preferences actually are? And so the first thing I'm showing here is, like, let's take a white male who has a, who based on all of how Harvard ranks you, would have a 5% chance of admission. Here's what their probabilities of being admitted would be if they were treated as members of different races, okay? And so you can see at Harvard, if you're not disadvantaged, and, but we treat you like an African-American, we're talking about an almost 70% chance. The number's actually even higher for UNC out-of-state admissions. What's going on there? The UNC case actually splits the conservative argument against affirmative action in half. What's the conservative argument? It would be either fairness, we shouldn't be making decisions based upon race, or two, or, the second one would be, we're putting people at schools where maybe they're not gonna do so well, okay? The more unfair would be the UNC out-of-state admissions. The preferences are much larger there. But those kids actually do well, are better prepared than the in-state admissions because the bar to get into UNC out-of-state is so much higher. So those guys, UNC out-of-state black admits, actually look a lot like white in-state admits. So the more unfair one would be the UNC out-of-state. The mismatch concern would be more UNC in-state. But the other thing I want to point out is how the preferences operate themselves. Okay, so there's actually one study that found that over 40% of black students at Ivy League schools are first or second generation immigrants. Okay, and if you look at the way these policies are targeted here with the actual data that we got from UNC and Harvard, you would get a bump, a large bump if you were black, a smaller bump if you were disadvantaged, but if you were black and disadvantaged, you didn't get that disadvantage bump. And that's the numbers you can see at the bottom panel, that those gains that you're getting are not as big for your race if you happen to be disadvantaged. Part of that could be concerns about mismatch, we don't want to give too many bumps, but there are other things that it could be as well. There's another way of calculating how big those preferences are. The first column, that actual admit rate, this is what they're at, you know, after we throw out people whose qualifications would mean that they have no chance of getting in. This is what the admit rate would be for African Americans. They're also throwing out the athletes and such. Preferences are actually biggest at Harvard for recruited athletes. And to Sonia's point, Harvard actually offers more varsity sports than any school in the country. And so we're, a lot of it, if you got rid of sports preferences, the only group that goes down is actually white students because it's talking about sports like sailing. And Justice Gorsuch talked about, kept bringing up squash at the Supreme Court hearing. So what you can see is the actual admit rates in that column there. The average marginal effect is like, that's how much of that actual admit rate is because of race. So if you got rid of that there, the no preference admit rate would be what's in that third column. So you go from 9.5 to 2.25, right? Again, this is without the legacies. Even with Harvard following the ruling completely, it wouldn't go down quite this much because of the way other preferences are operate. And of course, they are going to make adjustments. But the point is, these preferences are huge, okay? And so when we think about the scope for getting around it, it's difficult. It's difficult. There are things you can do. And in fact, the other expert witness for Students for Fair Admissions is a guy named Rick Kallenberg. And Rick Kallenberg was completely interested in race-neutral alternatives, okay? And what would those look like from Rick's perspective would be things like, well, we're going to give a lot bigger preferences for socioeconomic status, okay? So I bring that up because I want to be thinking about some of the trends here. And you know, one of the things that Sonia mentioned this about how they report this data. This thing just drives me nuts. I mean, the fact that admissions offices give you the racial breakdown of the class and give you numbers that add up to more than 100%. That's dishonest, and if you think they're being above board, So either they don't really understand how data works, or they're being dishonest. And that's not okay. I mean, I think one of the biggest problems with all this is, to the enforcement point, is how, you know, universities hide their data. And it's a real shame. So, but I've, the reason I chose these three schools is there are three of the schools that actually reported the numbers the way that you have to do it for the federal government. So these numbers actually add up to 100%, you know, shocking. And what you can see is what's going on. So the last year is the class post-SFFA. And you can see like Stanford and Princeton, they're sort of moving together. And then last year, Stanford drops quite a bit. Princeton does not. And the question is, does that signal anything? Amherst, the drop was even bigger. So the things that I'm looking for in terms of the hints, again, we can't, Sonia's correct, we can't say anything completely for sure because they hide their data. But as Justice Roberts pointed out, it was always in the past, universities would basically say, trust us. I don't think they've merited that trust in that regard. There's nothing less informative about how admissions works than hearing an admissions officer talk about this, right? It's like everything is a factor of a factor. You know, I don't know what to do with this. I still don't totally have figured out. I've got five boys, and say, well, how can I now get into one of these schools? I'm not so sure. But in any event, this is not fully what you would expect. So if Princeton's the place that's compliant, then what I expect to see is that they're the ones who really put even more emphasis on socioeconomic status after the ruling than the schools that saw the big drops. The evidence suggests that the schools that saw the smallest drop for Black and Hispanic students were also the schools overall, there are exceptions to this, that saw the smallest increase in Pell Grant students or first-generation college students. That points to there being something else going on. And, you know, there were other things they could do, like get rid of legacy preferences, get rid of the sports, and there was a lot of pressure at first to get rid of those legacy preferences. And it's just sort of died down a bit there. The one place where it's shown up is California has banned legacy admissions. That's even harder to enforce because at least some racial data gets reported to the government. I don't know how they're going to enforce that ban in California. So when I think about potential, you know, future lawsuits, you're sort of looking at that combination of changes in the demographics plus what's going on the socioeconomic front. But in the end, without the data, you know, it's very hard to say much, and universities tend not to be very forthcoming with regard to that. Thanks.
So imagine grandma has a heart attack, and you go with her to the hospital, rush to the hospital, you get there, and the triage nurse says, oh, your grandma, she needs medical help right away, but first you have to fill out this form and tell us what her race is. And you say, well, I'm not sure. Her dad's from Spain, her mom is from Armenia. And the nurse says, oh, okay, well, Armenians are officially white, and people from Spain are officially Hispanic. You want to put down Hispanic, we could get her in earlier. She'll be ahead of Mrs. Johansson. She put down white. But Mr. Jones, he's an immigrant from Nigeria. His wife, who came in with him, wasn't sure what to put down because she thought, oh, he's not African-American. But I explained to her that officially people from Africa, as long as they're American citizens, are considered African-American, and he is. So she put that down. He's going to go in first. Now, you might think this is a little crazy and dystopian, but there are a lot of people in the government, particularly in the outgoing government, and in the medical industry who see this as the future of medical care. And the reason that I'm raising this is I want to point out we have some great presentations about the effect of SFFA on university admissions, But in fact, it was also the first Supreme Court case to conclude that the racial classifications that the government has imposed on us since the 1970s and has dictated that we routinely use them when we apply for jobs and for loans and for school and to participate in medical research and all sorts of other things are arbitrary and presumptively unconstitutional. Now, I go in my book, Classified, which I'm holding up for those of you in the back. It is now available in paperback. Might as well get a plug in while I'm up here. Describes how these classifications came about in some detail, but I'll give you the really short version. In 1973, it occurred to the old Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. They were collecting throughout the government all this new data about racial minorities that they needed to fulfill the mandates of various civil rights laws and Great Society programs. The problem, however, was that there was no official or consistent way of dictating who you were supposed to gather data about and what the definitions of those groups were. So Hughes set up an interagency commission charged with creating official racial classifications. And after a process marked by a combination of lobbying, bureaucratic imperative, inertia, arbitrariness, and incompetence, this is after all the government, all described again in my book Classified, and by the way, with very little public controversy or input, in 1978, the Office of Management and Budget published Statistical Directive Number 15, maybe the most important rule in the Federal Register you've probably never heard of. Directive 15 sorted Americans into the now standard racial classifications, black, white, Hispanic, American Indian, and Asian American. Hispanic and Asian American in particular were pretty novel. 50 or 60 years ago, almost no one would have self-identified that way. So I feel a little compassion for people who are really pushing Latinx. Everyone says that's absurd. That would have been equally absurd to calling Cubans or Mexicans Hispanic 60 years ago. Anyway, OMB had no idea that it was institutionalizing permanent racial classifications that would have such a dramatic effect on government programs and American society. In fact, in the Federal Register, in the rule itself, it said these are not scientific in nature, they're not anthropological in nature, and in particular, these should not be used to determine eligibility for any federal program. Famous last words. Partly because these were the available criteria that were out there, and partly, I think, just coincidentally, the Bakke case happened to come out the same year, 1978, and now we have this new diversity criteria for admissions, and we have to figure out what the criteria are. Everyone started using the Directive 15 classifications as affirmative action classifications, and these eventually bled beyond affirmative action into things like medical research and other things, medical research thanks to some really silly laws passed by Congress in the 1990s. Despite the fact that Directive 15 classifications were never intended to be affirmative action classifications, none of the Supreme Court opinions until SFFA really dealt in any detail. They just sort of accepted that these classifications are somehow just natural and inevitable, perhaps in part because I think the litigants didn't push the issue. After SFFA, though, any government program that uses Directive 15 classifications to classify people are suspect as not being narrowly tailored to achieve their objective. In the opinion, Chief Justice Roberts denounced the Directive 15 classifications, without using the phrase Directive 15, I think, as imprecise, in turn both overbroad and underbroad, opaque, arbitrary and undefined. Justice Gorsuch elaborated on this in a concurring opinion, which Justice Roberts cited favorably. I see Corey Liu nodding. Justice Gorsuch relied on an opinion filed on my behalf by Corey, so I'm going to give Corey a wave later. The irony, though, about the persistence of these classifications is that anyone, really of any ideology, that looks into the classifications agrees that the scheme is almost comically arbitrary and irrational. So just for example, we have a new Middle East and North African classification that just came into being, but until then, until 2024, anyone from Iceland to the Middle East was classified as white, except if your ancestors happen to be from Spain. Then you're a member of a minority group. Why? That's just, it just is. Pakistanis and Filipinos and everyone in between geographically are all put into the Asian American classification, even though your average Pakistani and Filipino have nothing more in common, the way they look, their religion, their culture, anything else, than any two random individuals in the world. For that matter, there was some controversy, but it was resolved just to have one white category. A Hasidic rabbi in Brooklyn and a non-binary professor at UC Santa Cruz, who is of Icelandic and Greek descent, are also both in the same white classifications. All these classifications are, as Justice Gorsuch and Chief Justice Roberts pointed out, arbitrary and somewhat irrational. So why do they persist? Why haven't we had a fundamental reassessment of these classifications? Well, at least one reason is that many of our friends on the left are convinced that racial division in the United States is a permanent feature of American society. Therefore, if we want to achieve equity, we have to divide Americans into discrete groups and make sure each group is getting their fair share. If that's your underlying premise, it's actually a lot less important that the classifications make any logical sense, and that you have the classifications to begin with, and that way you can make sure each group is getting equity, as they call it. So I think we need to reject the underlying premise of inevitable permanent racial division that requires government to classify people routinely by race. And we have an example of why we shouldn't expect the status quo to stay the same way forever. All sorts of ethnic and religious conflicts that once permeated American life have basically gone away and indeed seem faintly ridiculous now. So I'm not quite old enough to remember this, but some of in the room may be. In 1960, when JFK was running for president, even though he started off with a base of 25% of Americans being Catholic, there was serious doubt whether a Catholic could be elected president of the United States. And indeed, millions of Protestants who normally voted Democrat refused to vote for JFK and voted for Nixon. Nixon did win anyway. Why? He got 82% of the Catholic vote. A lot of Catholics who normally voted Republican out of identity politics. We don't think of Catholics nowadays as having identity politics, but out of identity politics voted for JFK. So compare that to 60 years later. Not that long in the scheme of things. In 2020, the American people were represented by a Catholic president, a Catholic Speaker of the House, 6 Catholic justices on the Supreme Court, along with a Jewish Senate Majority Leader, 2 Jews on the Supreme Court, and of course a half black and half Asian vice president, not to mention a whole bunch of women. This would have been inconceivable to people in 1960. Remember, as of 1960, almost every position of power in United States history had been held by a Protestant white man. If you had told them in 60 years what I told you, which actually happened, they would have said, what happened? Did the Catholics take over somehow? Or maybe the Jews took over and they're just manipulating the Catholics, right? Who knows? But it just would have been inconceivable to them. And yet it attracted like no controversy as we all know. No one really cared. And more generally, if you think about the status of what used to be called white ethnics in the United States, if you were Greek or Polish or Jewish, Slavic, and so on, Armenian, you are excluded from not just country clubs, but law firms and insurance companies and all sorts of other businesses. And it was a big deal. And now, I'm old enough to remember this. Even less long ago than 1960, in 1986, one reason Justice Scalia was chosen to be a justice was it would be the first Italian-American. This would help with the white ethnic vote. And I went back, I looked at the Senate transcript when he was introduced to the Senate. The first, I forget which senator it was, but the senator said, distinguished jurist, Judge Anson Scalia is here. He will be the first Italian-American justice of the Supreme Court. And I tell my kids this, and they say, well, who cares? Why would anyone think that's important? That's just completely bizarre. It isn't. No one cares that DeSantis, when he was running, was Italian, right? We don't care anymore. The situation has completely changed. So trends in intolerance and in racial tolerance and intermarriage make a similar outcome with regard to race. In other words, the development of some sort of common, non-racial or multiracial American identity, the natural outcome of American society. People intermingle and intermarry and procreate in all sorts of couplings now when no one really cares. In 1958, 4, one digit percent of Americans approved of interracial marriage. Now it's 94% as of 2021. And among people under 30, it's like 98%. So this is a huge drastic change. And I think the natural evolution of this would be a common American identity. The problem is that the elites who control the government, academia, and big business are wedded to keeping these Directive 15 classifications. We should instead have the same policy we had for white ethnics, which is a matter of benign neglect. Now, we can't completely get rid of racial classifications, and we may not want to completely get rid of them because certain civil rights laws are basically unenforceable without them. How do you enforce the Voting Rights Act if you don't know who's voting in different counties and so forth? And I don't think we're getting rid of such laws anytime soon. But what we can do is establish two principles within the federal bureaucracy. And this draws, of course, on this test under equal protection law. The first is that we should only allow, much less require, racial classification if a government agency can show a compelling interest in doing so. So no more routine collection of this data. And second, if race must be used, the classifications should be narrowly tailored to the intended benefit. So instead of just always by default relying on Directive 15 classifications, what are we actually trying to accomplish? If we're trying to accomplish, for example, medical research to determine the genetic origins of a disease or how to fix a disease, using the Hispanic classification makes no sense whatsoever, since Hispanics could be of African, indigenous, white, or Asian origin, or any combination thereof. It makes zero sense, as we do, to require biomedical companies to use such a classification. On the other hand, we might want to go really broad, like with the hate crimes statistics. The FBI collects hate crime statistics on everything from the Directive 15 classifications to Mormons, people over 40, the disabled, right? Because a lot of different groups are subject to hate crimes, not just, they don't follow government mandates. People who hate other people don't look up the Federal Register before they decide who to hate. So to finish up, I'm going to close by paraphrasing my law school's namesake, Justice Scalia. To continue with our current system of government racial classification is to reinforce and preserve for future mischief the way of thinking that produced race slavery, race privilege, and race hatred. In the eyes of government and with regard to our rights and privileges as citizens, we should just be one race. It is American. Thank you.
So I may be showing my age a little bit, but I recall there was an SNL skit where Ed Koch, when he was the mayor of New York, came on, and throughout his skit, he would break character and say, "Have you seen my book, Mayor?" So David, I was hoping as you walked off, you would say again, "Did you see my book, Classified?"
I remember that. That was a great skit.
I have a copy. I should have brought it for you to sign. One of the common themes that I see throughout the discussion of the panelists, we have Peter, who is suggesting that universities have been less than transparent with the racial data of their admits. Sonia, you have talked about why the numbers may not drop as we look at the law schools, as we look at colleges and universities post-SFFA. And David, you've talked about the overbroad classifications. With all of those thoughts in mind, what, if anything, does enforcement look like? And I would turn that open that up to the panel. Post-SFFA, because Chief Justice Roberts has allowed some consideration of race, it's not completely prohibited, what does enforcement look like? Is there another wave of litigation? What does that look like? Anybody care to predict?
Well, I think it's really hard. I think enforcement in part looks like more lawsuits as the only way of getting access to the data. But it's, the amount of data that our government collects and makes public with regard to education, I think is very small compared to other places. So, you know, you could easily see requirements for certain federal funding and such to be related to actually revealing data. And I think this is sort of my hobby horse in general, is that, universities do not use their data. It's not just hiding their data, but they ought to be using their data to help their students, which they don't do, as a general rule. Let me just give you one example. When you go off to college, you learn that randomization is a great way to figure out how things work, right? So that's why we have randomized drug trials and so on. But then universities, what they do is they randomize, but then they don't learn from the data. So we do randomized roommates, but we don't ever figure out, well, what roommates actually work. And I think that, as a general rule, this hiding of the data has big implications beyond just enforcement of these rules. So I would like to see much more push to make the data more available.
And does anybody on the panel have any opinion as to, as we are undergoing a change in administration? For example, I read the statement that Harvard made right after the opinion was issued that said we're going to be considering how we move forward, but at the same time continue our values. And the Department of Justice put out a statement that remarkably looked quite similar to that and suggested that race indeed could consider to be considered under certain circumstances. Any predictions with a change in administration, what that the enforcement on the government side as opposed to sort of the private litigation might look like?
Well, you could actually see that just in the folding of the SFFA versus Harvard case, because the Trump administration filed a brief in support of students for fair admissions, and then at the Supreme Court, the Biden administration argued against students for fair admissions. So I think there's definitely going to be a push on enforcement there.
Well, this is kind of anecdotal, of course. I don't know who will be in the administration, but I have a college age and high school age daughter, so I look at programs for summer and, you know, and for applications. What I've seen is that a lot of universities that run summer programs and so forth seem to think that if they say, instead of this program is meant for people who are from underrepresented minority groups, they instead say it's for people of underrepresented minority groups and first generation college students and members of the military, and they add a couple of criteria that makes it legal. I do not think that is correct.
And I have one more question before I'm going to turn it over to the audience, so anybody who wants to go ahead and get in line. And just sort of jumping off, Sonia, one of the things that, wow, a lot of people. jumping off one of the things, Sonia, that you had said, that there you can still do race-neutral alternatives, but at what point do you envision that some of the race-neutral alternatives that you talked about might become indirect affirmative action that is, in fact, prohibited constitutionally?
I mean, I'm not sure that any of the specific examples that I gave are likely to be characterized as indirect affirmative action. I would think the type of circumvention you might worry about. So for instance, I've written about what I call the essay carve out in the Supreme Court's opinion, where they say that you can consider kind of qualitatively individualized evidence of race-related experience. And I think the Supreme Court means what it says. Like, you can, in fact, consider that kind of experience, but only if it is in a genuinely individualized way. And I think one thing that would be, I think, accurately characterized as indirect affirmative action would be if circumvention, basically, would be if the essays were basically just being used to collect information about race, which was then being used, everybody who wrote about disadvantage who was in one racial group kind of got a plus factor, and people writing about similar disadvantage in other groups didn't, right? So that'd be one type of thing I would imagine. And then, of course, you know, if schools are using things that are so closely, so many of the things that I discussed, they're correlated with race, like socioeconomic status, but they're not, the correlation's nowhere near one, right? Like not so close as to be race proxies, right? They measure something else that is substantive and important about a person's life, right? Like the actual barriers that they faced due to poverty. So I don't think that's a problem, but you know, if you could imagine, sort of more creative use of race proxies. So I don't know. I mean, I think this will play out. I guess I would just sort of say that we probably, like, everybody's kind of raring to go. To me, I think there's, like, other legal battles to be decided probably, like, before we worry that much about, like, I feel like let it play out for a few years. The first year isn't the be-all, end-all of, like, what's going to happen at these schools. It's going to take a while for those market effects to shake out in terms of effects on applications. Schools are going to continue to adjust their policies. And more information will probably come out. You know, if schools really are cheating behind the scenes, like, maybe, you know, some admissions officer is going to say so, right? Like, you know, it was a long, point is, like, I don't think necessarily litigation choices made, you know, this year are going to be the important ones in terms of shaping the future of law in this area. I do expect to see a lot of litigation right away about things like the extension of SFFA to employment, like to other contexts besides undergraduate admissions, right? That there's a lot out there still left to litigate. And those questions seem to me to be more teed up to go.
All right, we've got three microphones, and what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna go microphone, microphone, microphone. So I'm just gonna go like this, and we'll get to as many people as we can, but why don't you start?
I think they all have to go.
I don't have a strong view because I don't know the details of it, but one thing to keep in mind is that if you're talking about a government entity that has itself engaged in past discrimination, there may be like a remedial potential use of set-asides that could be justified under a different legal basis than diversity. But I expect that many of those programs, like, you know, I think that's the, I think the direction of at least narrowing their existence is to more particular circumstances like that. I think that probably is where the courts are gonna go. But it's not something I have dug deeply into.
The middle microphone.
So a centerpiece of the SFFA litigation had to do with Harvard's, the so-called personal rating, which took in like subjective considerations of character and personal excellence. And I imagine what's going to happen is even in light of like race blind considerations, you're still going to see disparities in whom those kind of metrics preference, and I imagine they'll be challenged in court. So my question is, how do we thread the needle between allowing non-objective, non-standardized considerations of excellence while still maintaining race neutrality, because of course America did not become an excellent nation just on the basis of picking the person with the highest standardized tests. They also took into consideration personal character and excellence. Thank you.
I'd say just jump in, anybody on the panel?
I think it's really hard, and I think part of the reason it's hard is you'd like to link these things to later outcomes. Yeah, so if you're gonna have a personal rating, I'd actually like to see it linked to something that actually matters, and you showing me that it predicts just as well for those people. One of the interesting things about the Texas top 10% rule is that the people who came in under the Texas top 10% rule actually did better than the people they pushed out, which shows you that Texas's holistic admissions was not doing a good job if you're going to measure it in terms of the performance in college. To the extent that it was pushing out people who are doing well in other dimensions, well, show it. And I think that that's actually generally an important rule, is we tend to be focused on inputs into the process. There has to be a link to the output. If the SAT doesn't predict anything, then they have a point about not using it. I think it does, particularly on STEM fields, but you have to show that it links to the outcomes in order to justify it. I think to me that's where I guess it would stand on. Enforcement's a whole other thing.
Yeah, I mean, I got to agree that, like, the, I think that the, that it is the case that we can get too hung up on numbers, not just the demographics that are being reported, but also on test scores and the, you know, that qualitative factors are important. On the other hand, I do think, like, it's a hugely important area in which, like, implicit biases can infect the way that we assess people. And, you know, I think in the Harvard case, Harvard was like a perfect defendant for SFFA to choose because some of the facts unrelated to Harvard's affirmative action program itself were just hugely embarrassing to Harvard. And like one of those facts was the systematic under, you know, the lower ratings given on these personality traits to Asian students. I don't know why Harvard didn't say, like, we're sorry, we're getting rid of that. This, like, our bad, but that isn't what our, the core of our affirmative action program, which we're still gonna defend, like, because, you know, that was bad. So I guess I have to agree that with the questioner that it's like, there's difficult factors to weigh here.
The third microphone.
It's me. I'd like to thank the panelists for good presentations. I've learned a lot. First, an anecdote. I attended a magnet school in New York City some years ago. And back then, you didn't have percentages, but you saw lots of blacks, lots of Asians, lots of whites. I couldn't tell you the percentages. Could be that blacks made 50%. I really don't know. 40 years later, recent years, it's overwhelmingly Asian, 60%, and about 5% blacks. And this has been met with outrage among elites and who are politicians and the public as well. And they've called for getting rid of the test that gets you into these schools. And even the elite of these magnet schools, the disparity is even greater than that racially. So just something for you to think about. So one, what is the definition of diversity? Two, why is it important? It just seems to me that the promotion of diversity is the cancer that we need to eradicate. So.
Anyone?
I think it's really interesting to think about. And in particular, one of the things that's been on my mind is, does somebody like Ibram Kendi provide more diversity or less than somebody like Roland Fryer? For those of you guys who don't know, Ibram Kendi is a big anti-racist guy. That would be more consistent with particular views. Roland Fryer, you can't put that guy into a box, but he has said things that might fit more with other groups besides a particular group. So they actually did something really interesting in Chile where we said we have to have gender quotas by political party. Well, and what was interesting about that is he actually ended up with affirmative action for men in the liberal parties and for women in the conservative parties. And there's something interesting about that because that's actually getting more of that population represented, but at a different level. And that's why I think that Roland Fryer question is really interesting. I think it's important that we don't end up putting people in these boxes, and somebody like him allows you to get outside of that.
You know, I think the university's lost whatever the original purpose of diversity was, and by the time SFFA came around, what we were really talking about was aesthetic diversity, by which I mean when you look at the view book that they send out to the students, does it look like we have enough students of each group? And it leads to some really bizarre results, including especially if you consider the classification issue. The example I always give, if you look at Fisher of a University of Texas, unlike, which was in the late 2010s, unlike traditional affirmative action litigation, which was sort of white versus black for the slots, this was really a question of, are we going to have more Hispanics or more Asians? And what I thought was strange about that is, imagine the Hmong Cambodian from Minnesota who sends a letter, you know, his application, I heard you're interested in diversity. I understand you've never had someone of my ethnic background at your school. And they would say, oh no, we already have 20% Asians, but let's take in our 3,000th Mexican-American student for more diversity.
So I guess I have to bite on the magnet school question. This is the issue I've written really the most about in this area. I am also the graduate of a magnet school, the Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology, which is at the center of some recent litigation. And I want to say that, you know, what TJ did with its similar that, by the way, was the thing that kind of drew me into this area of work. I used to just work on disparity and discrimination issues in the criminal justice context. I think TJ is a good example of a system that looked at a diversity challenge that it has. And I want to say TJ is a diverse school, always has been. It has, you know, it is a majority Asian population and a very diverse Asian community in Northern Virginia that comprises that Asian majority. So it's always been diverse, but Hispanic and Black students were sharply underrepresented and have been throughout the school's history. And you know, the solution that they landed on, it didn't involve affirmative action, doesn't involve classifying any students by race, also didn't involve getting rid of TJ as a magnet school and just lotterying admissions, which is what some people proposed. They have retained the you know, the essential character of the sort of super competitive school that it is. And they've done it largely by giving a plus factor to students on free and reduced price lunch, that is to poor students, which jumped after their admissions reform from 1% to 25% of the population. Fairfax County has something like a 30% overall average of students, so they basically brought that close to in line with the school system. You know, I think that's a huge win, and doing that bumped up indirectly the Black and Hispanic shares. You know, to me, that seems like a win, you know, the most important thing I want to say is it doesn't seem constitutionally problematic, right? Like, one can go to the school board meetings and argue with them about whether one or another of their of the choices that they made. Or they also got rid of a standardized test, right, which was a standardized prep test that people were prepping for as early as the third grade. Kind of sick. There were a lot of reasons to get rid of something that's that high stakes a test for such young children, right? You know, one can quibble about all of those things from a policy perspective, but I think it makes sense to leave it to the political process and to say that, you know, the choice among all of those alternatives, all of which were totally race neutral, is something that ought to be decided at the policy and at the level of policy and politics.
Clearly, you need a benchmark to define what diversity
is. You need to move forward.
Yeah, you clearly need a benchmark to define diversity. And so, like, in my presentation, I showed you the minority share of college grads, and we sort of use that as our benchmark of, like, applicants to law school. I think it's really hard to measure diversity, and, like, if you can't measure diversity, like, if you can't define it, how do you measure it? But I do think it's easier to identify instances when there's a lack of diversity. And so I study law schools a lot in my research, and so if you look at law school faculties, especially at top law schools, there are very few conservatives. And so, like, we have some updated data, it's like less than 10% at top 20 schools, something like that. And so, you know, sometimes it is easy to identify a lack of it, it's just a lot of times hard to define or measure different benchmarks that I think are useful.
We have time for one more question. My friend, Judge Boggs.
Significantly. Amherst dropped about half, same sort of thing. That's what the
anyone?
You know, I agree with Professor Starr that you can't easily draw conclusions from very limited data about specific schools. However, I do think that partly because the schools all signed an amicus brief saying they couldn't possibly keep their numbers the same without using race, but they did. Would certainly, if I were a plaintiff, or if I were a judge, I would be very reluctant to even entertain a motion to dismiss, given they signed that brief. But beyond that, what I find honestly kind of suspicious is not simply that some schools didn't change much, but there were a few schools, Duke, Yale, there was one other, where the numbers, the percentages were almost exactly the same for every category. And the odds of that happening randomly, if you've completely revamped your admissions process because of SFFA, seem to be quite small. Not impossible, I suppose, but quite suspicious.
Okay, but the odds that the numbers will be similar somewhere when you're looking at dozens of different schools are not that low, right? Like the fact is you have a kind of observer bias where you're searching for the ones that fit the story that you're waiting to pounce on. And of course, somebody in a large landscape where they're competing with each other is going to fit that story. Look, I don't know what's going on at Duke or Princeton or Yale. Like, I'm not here to say that for sure they're not circumventing SFFA. I just think that, you know, the mere fact that, like, MIT suddenly didn't admit that a bunch of black students didn't go to MIT, well, that maybe they're at Yale. Right? There's a limited pool of students. They compete for each other. What their competitors do matter. It's a complicated, and you know, MIT faced a bunch of negative headlines after its new numbers came out. People said, oh, look, MIT's numbers for black admits went way down. That just proves that it was racially discriminating earlier. Then Yale comes out with its numbers not changing. Nobody said, well, that just proves that Yale wasn't racially discriminating earlier, right? It's sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't if you're one of these schools. And so, you know, I think we need to not be so confident in our interpretation of numbers that fit like a narrative that we're looking for. We don't quite know what's happening.
I think that's a great place to end. And I'd like to thank all of our panelists, certainly to the audience for joining us. And one bit of housekeeping, there is a reminder that the next event, which is the Robert Bork Memorial Lecture and Reception, is starting right now. There's no break, and it's in